Chapter 18. The Yucatan, Mexico. Gamay was regretting her Star Trek comment. The Humvee hurtled along the narrow two-lane road at warp speed. She seemed to navigate with an advanced type of radar. Since he was too short to see over the top of the steering wheel, there could be no other explanation for the ease with which he whipped the wide-framed vehicle around potholes and suicidal armadillos. The woods on both sides were a verdant blur. Trying a ploy to slow him down, Gamay said, "Dr. Chi, how is your Mayan dictionary coming along?" The professor attempted to talk over the loud whir of the heavy-treaded tires and the rush of air around the boxy vehicle. Gamay cupped an ear with her hand. Chi nodded his understanding. His lead foot came off the accelerator, and he switched on the AC. Refreshingly cool air flowed from the vents.
"Don't know why I didn't do this before," he said. "Thank you for asking about the dictionary. Unfortunately, I have abandoned work on the project for the time being."
"I'm sorry to hear that. You must be busy at the museum." His response was an amused glance.
"My duties at the museum are not what I'd describe as demanding. As the only full-blooded Mayan on the staff, I rate a sinecure. I believe they call them no-show jobs in your country. In Mexico, these are time-honored positions that command great prestige. I'm actually encouraged to be out in the field away from the office."
"I don't understand, then. The dictionary?"
"Must play second fiddle to the greater need. I spend most of my time fighting the looters who are stealing our heritage. We are losing our historical artifacts at an alarming rate. 1,000 pieces of fine pottery are taken from the Mayan region every month."
1,000? Gamay said with an uncomprehending shake of her head. "I was aware you had problems, but I had no idea things were quite so bad."
"Not many people do. Unfortunately, it is not only the quantity of the stolen goods that is frightening, but the quality. The traffickers in contraband don't waste their time on inferior work. They take the very best. Codex-style ceramics of the late classic period, AD 600 to 900, command top dollar. Beautiful pieces. I wouldn't mind having some myself."
She stared out the windshield, lips pursed in anger.
"That is a tragedy. Many of the looters are chicleros who work the chicla plantations. A very tough breed. Chicla is the sap used to make chewing gum. In the past, when Americans chewed less, the chicla market dropped. The workers turned to looting, and we lost more of our culture. But it's worse now."
"In what way, Dr. Chi?"
"The chicla market doesn't make a difference now. Why break your back working in the fields when you can sell a good pot for $200 to $500? They've become used to the money. Looting is organized. Groups of full-time looters are hired by traffickers in Carmelita, in Guatemala. The artifacts are channeled there, loaded on trucks, and taken across the border to Belize. Then by ship or air to the U.S. and Europe. The artifacts bring thousands of dollars in the galleries and auctions, even more from museums and private collectors. It's not difficult to provide source documentation."
"Still, they must know many of these artifacts are stolen."
"Of course. But even if they suspect this, they say they are preserving the past."
"That's a lame excuse for erasing a culture."
"But what can you do about it?" "As I said earlier, I'm a finder. I try to locate sites before they can be looted. I make their location known only when the government can assure me that the sites will be guarded until we get the artifacts out of the ground. At the same time, I use my connections in the U.S. and Europe. The governments of the affluent countries are the ones who can bring the traffickers to jail, hit them where it hurts by confiscating their property.
It seems almost hopeless.
It is, he said gravely, and dangerous. With the stakes so high, violence has become commonplace. Not long ago, a Chiclero said, instead of sending Mayan artifacts out of the country, leave them alone where they are and bring the tourists in to see them. It would mean more money for all.
Not a bad idea. Did anyone listen to him?
Oh, yes. His mouth curled in a dark smile. Someone heard him loud and clear. He was killed.
Whoops!
He hit the brakes. The Humvee decelerated like a fighter jet, deploying a drogue chute, and swung to the right in a 12G turn.
Sorry! Chi yelled as they bumped over the shoulder and plunged toward the trees.
I get carried away. Hold on, we're going in! He shouted over the din of snapping branches and the roar of the engine. Gamay was sure they were headed for a crash, but Chi's sharp eye had seen what she hadn't, a barely discernible opening in the dense forest. With the professor hanging onto the steering wheel like some mad gnome, the lumbering vehicle crashed through the woods. They bounced along for nearly an hour. Chi followed a route that was entirely invisible to Gamay, and she was surprised when he announced they were at the end of the track. The professor maneuvered the vehicle around, taking down at least an acre of vegetation, pointed out, and switched off the motor.
Time for a stroll in the woods.
Chi exchanged his straw hat for a Harvard baseball cap, worn with the visor facing backward so it wouldn't catch on branches. While he unloaded the packs, Gamay changed from shorts into jeans that would protect her legs from thorns and briars. Chi slipped his arms through the straps of the rucksack holding their lunch, slung the shotgun over his shoulder, and hung the machete from a scabbard tucked into his belt. Gamay carried a second pack with the camera and notebooks. With a quick glance at the sun's position to get his bearings, he set off into the woods in a ground-covering scuttle. Gamay had an athletic figure with long legs, small hips, and medium bust. She was a tomboy as a girl, always running with a gang of boys, building tree houses, playing baseball in the streets of Racine, Wisconsin. As a grown woman, she became a fitness nut, deep into holistic medicine, and running and biking and hiking during family four-wheeling trips into the Virginia countryside. At 5'10", Gamay was nearly a foot taller than the professor. As lithe and fit as Gamay was, she had trouble keeping up with Chi. He seemed to melt through branches she had to push aside. His quiet passage through the forest made Gamay imagine she must sound like a cow crashing through the bushes. Only when Chi stopped to hack away with his machete at vines barring the way did she get a chance to catch her breath. On one such halt, after they had climbed up a small hill, he pointed to broken pieces of limestone layering the ground.
This is part of an old Mayan road. Raised, paved causeways like this run between cities all over the Yucatan. Good as anything the Romans built, traveling should be easier from now on.
His prediction proved true. Although the grass and bushes were still thick, the solid underpinning made for easier walking. Before long, they stopped again, and Chi indicated a low line of fallen stones that ran through the trees.
Those are the remains of a city wall. We're almost there.
A few minutes later, the forest thinned, and they broke out of the trees into the clear. Chi slid the machete into its sheath.
Welcome to Shangri-La.
They were at the edge of a plain about a half mile in diameter, covered with low bushes and broken here and there by trees. It was unremarkable except for odd-shaped, steep-sided mounds, hidden under dense vegetation that rose from the grass between where she and the professor were standing and the tree line on the far side of the field. Gamay blinked in the abrupt change from shade to bright sunlight. "It's not quite how I pictured Utopia," she said, wiping the sweat from her eyes. "Well, the neighborhood has gone downhill in the last 1,000 years or so," Dr. Chi lamented. "But you must admit it's quiet." The only sound was their own breathing and the drone of a million insects. "I think the term is deathly quiet." "What you see is the area immediately around the main one-acre plaza of a fair-sized settlement. Buildings stretched out for 3 miles on each side with streets in between. Once this place bustled with little brown-skinned people like me. Priests in feathered regalia, soldiers, farmers, and merchants. Wood smoke hung in the air from hundreds of huts, no different from my house. The sound of infants crying, drumbeats, all gone. It makes you think, doesn't it?" Chi's gaze was fixated, as if the visions in his mind had come alive. "Well," he said, pulling himself back into the present, "I'll show you why I dragged you into the wilderness. Stay right behind me. There are holes all over the site that drop down to old dome-shaped cisterns. Some of them I've marked. I might have a hard time pulling you out. If you keep to the paths, you'll be fine." Warily eyeing the waist-high grass to either side of the rough trail, Gamay loped after the professor as he made his way across the field. They came to the foot of a mound covered with thick tendrils of vegetation. It was about 30 feet high and 60 feet at the base. "This is the center of the plaza, probably a temple to a minor god or king. The summit collapsed, which is what has saved the site from being discovered. The ruins are all below treeline and don't stick up out of the forest. You really can't see this place unless you're standing right on top of it."
"It's lucky you were hunting in the vicinity," Gamay ventured.
"It would be more dramatic if I stumbled out of the woods onto these ruins in pursuit of a partridge, but I cheated. I have a friend who works for NASA. A spy satellite mapping the rainforest saw a vague rectangular spot. I thought it looked interesting and took a closer look. That was nearly 2 years ago. I've been back a dozen times. On each visit I clear away more paths and vegetation from the monuments and buildings. There are other ruins in the surrounding woods. I think it might turn out to be an important site. Now, if you'll come this way." Like a guide conducting a museum tour, Chi led Gamay along the path to a cylindrical structure that had been hidden behind a heavily grown mound. "I've devoted my last 2 visits solely to clearing away this building." They walked around the edifice, which was built of finely fitted brownish-gray stone blocks. Gamay peered up at the rounded roof that had partially collapsed in on itself.
"Unusual architecture," she said. "Another temple?"
Talking as he worked, Dr. Chi cut away the snaking vines that were boldly trying to reclaim the building. "No, this is actually a Mayan celestial observatory and time clock. Those ledges and window openings are laid out so that the sun and stars would shine in according to the equinoxes and solstices. At the very top was an observatory chamber where astronomers could calculate the angles of stars. But here, this is what I wanted to show you." He brushed away new vegetation from a frieze about a yard in width that ran around the lower part of the wall, then stepped back and invited Gamay to take a look. The frieze was carved at Mayan eye level, and Gamay had to bend low. It was a nautical scene. She ran her long fingers over a carving of a boat. The vessel had an open deck and a high stern and bow. The stem was elongated into what looked like a pointed battering ram. Billowing from the thick mast was a large square sail. There was no boom, the rope brails holding the top of the sail fastened to a permanent yard, lines sweeping fore and aft to the overhanging stern, a double steering oar. Seabirds flew overhead, and fish leaped from the water near the bow. The craft bristled with so many spears it resembled the back of a porcupine. The weapons were in the hands of men wearing what looked like football helmets. Other men rowed with long oars that were angled back along the side of the ship. There were 25 rowers, which meant there would have been a total of 50, counting those on the side not visible. What appeared to be a row of shields hung off the rail. She used the human figures to estimate the approximate size of the craft at more than 100 feet. Moving along the frieze, she saw more warships and what appeared to be merchant vessels with fewer soldiers, the decks crowded with rectangular shapes that could have been boxes for goods. Men, she assumed, were ship's crew, stood in the yardarm hauling on lines to trim the sail. In contrast to the helmeted men, they wore odd, pointed headgear. The motifs were varied, but this was clearly a flotilla of merchants being escorted by armed protectors. Chi watched her walk around the building, an amused gleam in his dark eyes, and she realized he never intended to show her carvings of marine life. He wanted her to see the ship scene. She stopped at one ship and shook her head. On the bow of the boat was the carving of an animal.
"Dr. Chi, doesn't this look like a horse to you?"
"You asked me to show you sea life."
"Have you dated this?"
He stepped forward and ran his finger along the inscribed border.
"These carved faces are actually numbers. This one represents zero. According to the hieroglyphics that are carved here, these ships were pictured about 150 years B.C.
"If that date is even remotely correct, how could this ship be carved with a horse's head? Horses didn't arrive until the 1500s when the Spanish brought them in."
"Yes, it is certainly a puzzle, isn't it?"
Gamay was looking at a diamond shape in the sky over the ships. Hanging from it was the figure of a man.
"What on earth is this?" she said.
"I'm not sure. I thought it was some kind of sky god when I first saw it, but it's none I recognize. This is a great deal to absorb all at once. Are you hungry? We can come back and look at this again."
"Yes, fine," Gamay said, as if coming out of a daze.
She had trouble pulling herself away from the carvings, but thoughts were buzzing around in her head like a swarm of bees. A few steps away was a round, drum-shaped stone about a yard high and a couple of yards across. While Gamay went behind the monument and changed from her jeans to more comfortable shorts she'd brought in her pack, she prepared lunch on the stone's flat top. The professor took a small woven mat and cloth napkins from the rucksack and spread them out over the carved figure of a Mayan warrior in full feathered dress.
"Hope you don't mind eating on a blood-stained sacrificial altar," she said with a poker face.
Gamay was catching on to the professor's morbid humor. "If the sharp stub I just sat on is any indication, this was once a sundial."
"Of course," he said innocently.
"Actually, the sacrificial altar is over there near that temple." He dug into the rucksack. "Spam and tortilla roll-ups." Handing Gamay her neatly wrapped sandwich, she said,
"Tell me, what do you know about the Maya?"
She unwrapped the clear plastic and nibbled a bite of tortilla before answering.
"I know that they were violent and beautiful at the same time."
She swept her hand in the air.
"That they were incredible builders. That their civilization collapsed, but nobody is certain why."
"It is less of a mystery than some suppose. The Mayan culture went through many changes in the hundreds of years of its existence. Wars, revolutions, crop failures, all contributed. But the invasion of the conquistadors and the genocide that followed put an end to their civilization.
While those who followed Columbus were killing our people, others were murdering our culture. Diego de Landa was a monk who came in with the conquistadors and was made bishop of Yucatan. He burned all the Mayan books he could find. "Lies of the devil," he called them. Can you imagine a similar catastrophe in Europe and the damage it would have done? Even Hitler's stormtroopers were not so thorough. Only 3 books escaped destruction that we know of.
So sad. Wouldn't it be wonderful if more were found one day?
Gamay surveyed the plain from their perch.
What is this place?
I thought at first that it was a center of pure science, where research was conducted away from the bloody rituals of the priests. But the more I uncovered, the more I became convinced that it was actually part of a greater plan. An architectural machine, if you will.
I don't think I understand.
I'm not sure I do either. He produced a bent cigarette from his shirt and lit up, saying, "One is allowed small vices with age." He took a puff. "Let me start with the micro, the frieze and the observatory."
"And the macro?"
"The sighting I was talking about. I have found similar structures at other sites. Together with other buildings, they remind me of a rather large printed electrical circuit."
Gamay couldn't help smiling.
"Are you saying that the Maya could add computer science to their other accomplishments?"
"Yes, in a crude way. We're not looking at an IBM machine with endless gigabytes. More like a code machine, perhaps. If we knew how to use it, we could decipher the secrets in these stones. Their placement is no accident. The precision is quite remarkable, as a matter of fact."
"Those carvings, so strange. The horse's head. Did the hieroglyphics say anything about the inscriptions?"
"They tell of a long voyage many years before, with hundreds of men and great riches."
"Have you ever heard the story elsewhere in Mayan lore?"
"Only at the other sites."
"Why here, though? So far from the coast?"
"I've wondered the same thing. Why not at the monuments at Tulum, right on the Gulf? Come, I can show you something that might offer an explanation."
They packed up and walked to the far edge of the plain where the woods resumed, then through the trees and down a gradual slope. The air cooled a few degrees and took on a muddy smell as they descended to the edge of a slow-moving river. Pointing, Chi said, "You can see where the banks are eroded higher up, which means the river was wider at one point."
"Someone on the research ship said there were no streams or rivers in the Yucatan."
"True, the Yucatan is mostly a big limestone slab. Lots of caves and cenotes where there are holes in the limestone. We're more south in Campeche, where the terrain is a little different. As you move into the Petén and Guatemala, the big Mayan cities are actually located on waterways. That's what I was thinking here, that perhaps the boat was a ferry between settlements."
"You're right. There was a river, but I don't think it was large enough for a vessel of that size. With the high bow and sides, the rugged stem, that vessel was made for the open sea. There was something else. What I first thought were fish are dolphins. Saltwater creatures."
She paused.
"What's that?"
The sun had glinted off something shiny in the distance. She walked a few paces downstream with Chi coming up behind her. A battered aluminum pram powered by an old mercury outboard was pulled up onto shore.
"This must have drifted in from somewhere."
Chi was less interested in the boat than in the footprints in the mud. His eyes darted into the surrounding woods.
"We must go," he said quietly.
Taking Gamay's hand in a firm grip, he led her on a zigzag course up the hill, his head moving back and forth like a radar antenna. Near the top of the slope he halted, and his nostrils flared like a hound's.
"I don't like this," he said in a hushed tone, sniffing the air.
"What's going on?" she whispered.
"I smell smoke and sweat.
Chicleros, we must leave."
They skirted the edge of the woods, then picked up a path that would take them across the plain. They were passing between a pair of square-shaped mounds when a man stepped out from around the corner of one of the hillocks and blocked their way. Chi's hand flew to his scabbard, whipped the machete out in a blur of metal, and held the long, sharp-edged blade cocked menacingly above his head like a samurai. His jaw jutted forward, projecting the defiance that had so amazed the Spanish conquistadors who fought a bloody war of subjugation against his ancestors. Gamay marveled at how quickly this gentle elf of a man transformed himself into a Mayan warrior. The stranger wasn't impressed. He grinned, showing great gaps in his yellow teeth. He had long, greasy black hair, and a stubble on his face that didn't quite hide the syphilitic scars of his jaundiced complexion. He wore the standard Mexican campesino garb of baggy pants, cotton shirt, and sandals, but in contrast to the immaculate appearance of the poorest Yucatan native, he was dirty and unwashed. He looked to be a mestizo, a cross between Spanish and Indian, and flattered neither group. He was unarmed, but didn't seem worried about the upraised machete. A second later, Gamay learned the reason for his equanimity.
"Buenos dias, señor, señora," said a new voice.
Two more men had come around the other side of the mound. The closer one had a barrel-shaped body and short arms and legs. A high Elvis-style black pompadour of thick hair surmounted a face that looked as if it could have come off a Mayan carving. He had slanted eyes, a wide, blunt nose, and cruel lips like two pieces of liver. The muzzle of his aged hunting rifle was pointed in their direction. The third stranger stood behind Elvis. He was bigger than the other two put together. He was clean, and his white pants and shirt looked freshly laundered. His long, dark sideburns were as neatly trimmed as was his thick mustache. His belly was round, but the thick arms and legs were muscular. He loosely held an M16 and carried a holstered pistol on the wide belt that supported his large gut. Smiling pleasantly, he spoke to Chi in Spanish. The professor's eyes went to the M16. Then he slowly lowered the machete and let it fall to the ground. Next, he slipped the shotgun off his shoulder. He put it down next to the machete. Without warning, Yellow Teeth stepped forward and struck Chi across the face. The professor weighed about 100 pounds, and the blow practically lifted him off the ground and sent him sprawling into the grass. Instinctively, Gamay stepped in between the stricken professor and his assailant to ward off the kick she expected would follow. Yellow Teeth froze, staring at her with surprise. Instead of cowering, she skewered him with a warning glance, then turned and bent to help the professor to his feet. She was reaching for his arm when her head was jerked backward, as if her hair were caught in a wringer, and for a second she thought her scalp was being ripped off. She fought for her balance only to be jerked back again. Yellow Teeth had his fingers wrapped in her long hair. He pulled her close to him, so close that when he laughed she practically gagged at his fetid, oniony breath. But her white-hot anger drowned out the pain. She relaxed slightly to gain slack and make him think she was no longer resisting. Her head was at an angle, and from the corner of her eye she glimpsed his sandal. Her sneakered foot came down on his instep, and she put her whole weight of 135 pounds into her heel, which she gyrated as if she were grinding out a lighted cigarette butt. He let out a swinish grunt and loosened his grip. Gamay could see the blur of his face out of the corner of her eye. Her elbow swung back in a short, hard arc and caught his nose and cheekbone with a satisfying crunch of cartilage. He yelled shrilly, and she was free. She whirled around, disappointed that he was still standing. He was holding his nose, but anger diffused his pain too, and he started for her, dirty fingers aimed at her throat. He was a miserable excuse for a human being, but Gamay knew she would still be no match for his weight and male strength. When he grabbed her, she would feint a knee to his groin, a street fighter move he might expect. Then she'd drive her knuckles into his eye sockets and see how he liked that. She tensed as he came at her.
Basta!
The big man, who looked like Pancho Villa, had yelled. His mouth was still smiling, but his eyes glittered with anger. Yellow Teeth stepped back. He rubbed his face where a bruise was forming against the unhealthy skin. He backed off and grabbed at his crotch. The message was clear.
I got something to give you, too, he said in English.
He retreated when Gamay took a quick step toward him, setting his companions off into gales of dirty laughter. Pancho Villa was intrigued by the fearless reaction of this slender woman. He moved forward.
Who are you?
He said, his eyes boring into hers. I'm Dr. Gamay Trout. This is my guide, she said quickly, helping Chi off the ground. Chi's knowing expression told her that he understood he might face a bleak future if these men knew his identity. He adopted a groveling, servile attitude. The big man dismissed Chi with a contemptuous glance and concentrated his attention fully on Gamay.
What you doing here?
I'm an American scientist. I heard about the old buildings and came out to see what they were. I got this man to take me here. He studied her for a moment.
What did you find?
Gamay shrugged and looked around. Not much. We just got here. We saw some carvings over there, that's all. I don't think there's much to see. Pancho Villa laughed and said,
You didn't know where to look. I show you.
He rattled off an order in Spanish. Yellow Teeth nudged Gamay with the shotgun, but backed away when she gave him a fierce look. Instead, he concentrated his anger on Dr. Chi, knowing she didn't like it. They trekked to the far side of the plain to where the ground was scarred by a dozen or so trenches. Most were empty except for one filled with pottery. At Pancho's order, Elvis retrieved two pots from the trench and stuck first one, then the other, under her nose.
"This what you're looking for?" the big man said.
She heard a sharp intake of breath from Chi and hoped the others didn't notice. Taking one pot in her hands, she examined the figures drawn in black lines on the cream-colored surfaces. The scene seemed to represent a historic or legendary event. The ceramics were examples of the codex-style pottery Dr. Chi had mentioned earlier. She handed the pot back. Very nice.
Very nice, Pancho Villa echoed. Very nice. Ha ha! Very nice!
After a short and vocal conference, the looters marched their captives for a few more minutes. Pancho Villa led the way. Elvis and Yellow Teeth rode shotgun behind them. They headed toward a grassy mound that was partially exposed to show the stones beneath the vegetation. Pancho walked through a corbelled arch and seemed to disappear. Gamay saw that the building housed a large orifice in the ground. They descended a flight of irregular, rough-cut steps into the semi-darkness to a dank underground chamber with a lofty roof. The big man said a few words to Chi. Then they were left alone. "Are you all right?" Gamay asked the professor, her voice echoing. He rubbed the side of his face, which was still reddish where he'd been hit.
"I will live, but I can't say the same for the animal who struck me." "And you?"
Rubbing her scalp where it hurt, Gamay said, "I needed a perm anyhow." For the first time, a wide grin broke his stony expression.
"Thank you. I might have been dead if it weren't for your intervention."
Maybe, Gamay said.
Remembering the upraised machete, she guessed the professor would have cut Yellowteeth down to size. She looked back toward the stairs they had come down.
What did the big man say? He says he won't bother tying us up. There is only one way out. He will have someone at the entrance, and if we try to get away, he will kill us. He couldn't have been more direct than that. It's my fault, she said glumly. I should not have brought you here. I never dreamed looters had found this place.
From the looks of that pottery, they've been hard at work.
The artifacts in that ditch are worth hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of dollars. The big man is the boss. The other two are just hired men. Pigs. He paused. It was well that you didn't say who I was.
I didn't know how far your fame had spread, but I didn't want to take any chances they knew who you were.
She looked up at the high roof, which was barely visible in the light coming through the entrance.
Where are we?
It's a cenote, a well where the people who lived here came for their water. I found it on my second trip. Come, I'll show you.
They went in for about 100 feet. The darkness deepened, then lightened as they came to a large pool of water. The light streamed from an opening in the rocky roof, she estimated was about 60 feet high. On the far side of the basin was a steep wall that went up to the ghostly glow of the ceiling.
The water is pure, Dr. Chi said. The rainfall collects under the limestone and finds its way here and there to the surface through holes like this and underground caves.
Gamay sat on a low ledge.
You know this breed, she said. What do you think they'll do?
Dr. Chi was amazed at his companion's calm manner. He shouldn't be surprised, he reminded himself. She had shown no fear defending him and going after the man who attacked him.
We have some time. They won't do anything until they confer with the traffickers who hired them about what to do with an American.
Then what?
He spread his hands.
They have little choice. This is a lucrative excavation that they won't want to abandon, which is what they will have to do if they let us go.
So it will be better for them if we disappear from the face of the earth. Nobody knows where we are, although they don't know that. People might think we'd been eaten by a jaguar.
He raised a brow.
They wouldn't have been so free in showing us their loot if they thought we'd be around to tell anybody.
She looked around.
You wouldn't know a secret way out of here.
There are passageways off the main chamber. They either end or descend below the water table and are impassable.
Gamay got up and walked over to the edge of the water.
How deep do you suppose this is?
It's hard to say.
You mentioned underwater caves. Any chance that this comes up someplace else?
Possible. Yes, there are other water holes in the area.
Gamay stood a minute at the water's edge, trying to probe the depths with her eyes.
What are you doing? The professor called after her.
You heard what that creep said. He wants a date with me.
She dove in, breast-stroked out into the middle of the basin.
"Well, he's not my type," she said, her voice echoing in the chamber.
And, with a splash, she disappeared beneath the still water.